We have something that is comparable to an archaeological site, to Pompeii. We have a real sequence of buildings, roads, thermal complexes, everything, but it's underwater.
Hello and welcome to the Dive and Dig podcast that takes you on an underwater journey right across the ancient world from the Stone Age to the end of the Roman Empire. I am Bethany Hughes.
And I'm Lucy Blue, and you may have detected from the accent of our first interviewee that we are actually in Italy this week, and we're exploring the staggering archaeological marine park of Baia on the Bay of Napoli, where there are the most remarkable remains, a sunken Roman city beneath the waters as deep as 3 to 6 metres. This is really, truly a site I'd love to dive.
It's incredible, Lucy. I mean, it's so exciting historically because it's basically the sort of Sin City or the suburbs of Sin of the great and the good, the emperors and, you know, the wealthy of the Roman Empire. And I don't want to tell you, you're going to hate me, but I did dive. I went there and I did dive. I'm so sorry.
Okay. Go on then. Tell me what you saw.
it was all just like a dream. So I was diving with somebody. He's Italian, but he was called Dionysus, which is, of course, the ancient Greek god of wine and ecstasy and excess and delight. You know, he's also called Bacchus in the Roman world. And, you know, he went down and he found a beautiful little, probably first century CE fragment of a beautiful bit of dining ware just when I was there, which of course he put right back where he found it. But it was all very, very dreamy. So when I went, I did do a little dive, and then I just had to meet the incredible archaeology team who are working out there. I'm standing with Michele Stefanelli, the senior research fellow at the Scuola Superiore Meridionale. We've got a beautiful view out over the Bay of Baia. I can see the castle of Baia ahead of me and stretching out kind of modern developments. But this was a place that was extraordinary in ancient Roman times, wasn't it?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. If you look, you can see the beauty of the landscape, but you have to, you know, make a little effort of imagination just to imagine how it was in the Roman time. Just consider that you are in the middle of a caldera, so you are in the middle of a volcanic landscape with volcanic mountains, volcanoes, craters, lakes, thermal springs everywhere, all a trait of coast with maritime villas, imperial palaces and big structures in the sea, on the hillside, on the lakes, everywhere. So it was something amazing. In front of us, where you can see, there is a little hill, little promontory, just in the middle of the sea. This is Capo Miseno. Capo Miseno, it was the biggest naval bases of the Roman fleet of the Western Mediterranean. So it was the center of the naval power of Rome. On the other side, but it's 1 kilometer from here, we have Puteoli. Puteoli, it was the biggest commercial harbor of Rome in the Republican time, with enormous cargoes of food coming from Egypt, coming from all the shores of Mediterranean, arriving here. We have underwater an uninterrupted sequence of granaries, of storage rooms for all this food, all this stuff.
So yes, I mean, as you're saying, it's this extraordinary wealth of material down here. I think there are more mosaics, Roman mosaics underwater here than anywhere else in the world. And it's really interesting that you actively encourage visitors. I mean, people are invited to carefully, but to come and look at what is underwater.
You know, this was considered also as a best practice in underwater archaeology, because it is an archaeological park, like Pompeii, like every archaeological park in the world, but it is underwater. It means that it's open 7 days, seven, all the week, all the day, all the night. You cannot close and fence an underwater area. You cannot put carabinieri everywhere just to protect the boundaries. You have to imagine something different if you want to protect this. And if you consider that you are in very shallow waters, so practically everyone can dive here with no particular abilities. People by snorkeling, you can access the site with no problems. The unique thing you can do is to involve people in the protection of the site. And if you want to involve people in the protection of the site, you have to show the site.
I'm just listening, I can hear, is that the train that goes around
yeah.
the Vesuvius? Oh, that's so cool. I love it. It's my favourite train in the world. It kind of goes around the edge of the volcano. Sorry to interrupt.
No, yeah. So 20 years ago, this diving centre, they were just working with the classical scuba diving tour. But when the Ministry of Culture started to allow the diving center to take people to the underwater park, to the mosaics, the diving center converted themselves in the first protectors of the site. You just have to explain to people that this is a real resource. We are at the beginning of something that can be really big, because we have, as you said, an entire territory with lot of archaeological stuff that we just need to study and to cross with all our, the other sources at our disposal. So,
you know, I want to get into that sea now and have a look for myself. Thank you, grazie.
Thank you, grazie mille voi.
And you did.
I did, I'm afraid. I know.
I'm not jealous at all. So what, okay, you described these mosaics, but how much can you see from the boat as well? Because some of these, the remains are not that deep.
No, they're not. I mean, you can, and they have these kind of glass-bottomed boats there, so you can go over, and it obviously depends on what the conditions are like, whether the kind of silt's risen up. But, I mean, no, I was free diving, and, you know, within 4 or 5 seconds I could get down and see some of the sculptures on the seabed. So it is staggering, and he's quite right. There is so much there, and how on earth do you protect it? And it's like a little pleasure harbour. So this notion of having kind of, you know, sort of citizen archaeologists in a way, I suppose is the only way, and it's a really good one. It's quite, I don't know, what do you think about it, Lucy? Mm. It's quite a radical idea, that, isn't it?
Well, yes and no. I mean, it's something that we're increasingly doing with archaeology, because, I mean, as he quite rightly says, you can't police everything, particularly when you've got these vast expanses of remains underwater, or even, you know, random shipwrecks off the shore. So I think we are trying to engage people with something even called adopt a wreck, you know, so you're sort of bringing people to gain some ownership, I guess, and connection, because that's, after all, what really binds people to underwater archaeology, is a sense of connection and something that is, you know, that they reflect on their own histories or their own experiences or their region or that sort of thing. So I think it's certainly a way forward, and I think it's a concept that they're using quite a lot with these marine parks.
Everybody, ordinary people, can be kind of custodians of the past and of this underwater archaeology. And, oh my goodness, in the Bay of Baia, it is quite a past. So, I mean, honestly, Lucy, I'm not exaggerating. It's making me blush to think about what was going on there, because it was just, I think it was like sort of Brighton on acid. You know, it was kind of, they were going down there to let their hair down, to have these wild dining parties. It is very lush because it's a volcanic landscape. There is something kind of heady and sensuous about this place. And of course, all these hot water springs meant you could have sort of hot water bubble baths naturally. I mean, yeah. It's an extraordinary place.
No, I know. And there's one story that stands out in particular for me, which I sort of became aware of some years ago, which was probably one of the most elaborate and maddest of all the emperors. Before he became an emperor, Caligula, who you're probably familiar with, his astrologer basically said, "What, you're as likely to become an emperor as you are to ride across this bay." And so then he sort of basically got people to get a whole load of boats that he'd impounded, loaded them up so they sunk, and formed this massive pontoon. And guess what? Of course, got on his horse and rode across the bay, which I just think is, it sort of sums up the madness of the whole thing. It's all about extremes and extravagance. So, yes, I think it would have been fun. It would have been good party area.
Definitely.
2,000 years ago.
Definitely, yeah. Definitely all about opulence and excess. But, you know, as we're saying, it's really interesting because people, people were physically excessive. So there is a lot of stuff there, you know, now left on the seabed that kind of waiting to be discovered.
Mm. And that's also creating problems, as you hinted at, because it's a vast area, you know, this whole issue of policing, but also the conservation challenges it presents. And it's almost like a first in a way. I've been friendly for a very long time with this wonderful woman called Barbara David, and she sort of heads up the Institute of Conservation and Restoration. Actually, she's just recently become head of underwater archaeology on the mainland in Italy. And I was able to sort of grab her and ask her a few more questions about the issues of conservation and preservation.
It's important to understand that when we decide to open to the public to share this information, we have to study the site. So the first action of the underwater archaeologist is to study, to document in deep the archaeological site, to do the excavation if is necessary. So the first step is the knowledge of the site. Then we can prepare and design the better to share knowledge with general public. Sometimes just a small portion of the archaeological site, just to show to the divers the remains, the archaeological remains, but also is important that the divers know that if they want to see in for the future the archaeological remains, they have to protect and to cover them when the visits are closed.
Okay, we've got the diving community, and obviously that's fairly straightforward. They can put their scuba gear on and go underwater and follow some, you know, rules about not picking things up, I presume. But in terms of the rest of us who don't dive, what mechanisms are you deploying to give access to the people to actually view these incredible remains?
We have tested and we use in Baie and in another site, Egnazia in Apulia, where there is a Roman arbor submerged. In these two places, we have done, thanks to the Internet of Underwater Things, we have done the tablet that, thanks to this tablet, divers can see augmented reality directly underwater. It's very important news for the way of visit underwater archaeological site. I think that is the future for underwater archaeology, the use of the Internet of Things underwater. And it's really impressive because you can dive using this tablet, ask some information about the site, you can read, and as using a GPS, you can swim and see the reconstruction of the ancient villa as was in the past and as it is. I think that the knowledge of underwater cultural site and the new technologies can help very much for the future also to open and to protect, because thanks to these technologies we can also monitoring the underwater archaeological site. It's important to study the site, to open and show something to the public, to understand if it's possible to open, because some materials have to be covered by the sand, like for example wood. It's impossible to show to the public the wood of the wreck. So it's important to study well the site, to study well the opportunities, and to link not only archaeology, university that study archaeology, but also engineers, physicians, biologists, a multidisciplinarity. It's important now to work all together with other colleagues and experts.
That is also a really exciting element of what you're doing, is making these holistic links and the interdisciplinarity, as you mentioned, which is so progressive. I mean, I think you're doing so much that is just like the first. It's pioneering. It's really exciting. I'll tell you what, Bethany, this idea of having VR, virtual reality, underwater so that the divers can somehow, through their masks, actually see reconstructed sites, it's really cool.
It's really cool. It's really pioneering. And I know above ground, that's a kind of application that's very, very popular, increasingly popular. And going back to the theme that you and I talk about a lot, it's not just giving people facts, it's making them care about the world that they're entering. But I mean, how incredible to think. That's so cool. So divers, or even, you know, you could do a little bit of snorkeling and then suddenly the dining room of Claudius appears beneath you in the Bay of Bio, whatever it is. I mean, that's just staggering.
Yeah, you become immersed within it. It would be... Right, I'm definitely going back.
Definitely. She sounds like a very cool woman. I'd love to meet her. Lucy, I've just got to admit this. I mean, I'm genuinely embarrassed to confess this. But whenever I go to Bio, people always say to me, oh, and how come it is submerged? And I just sort of mumble something vague and general about it being a very geoseismic area. But I don't actually know. Do you?
Well, I think, as I understand, no, I think you're absolutely right. It's all to do with the volcanic nature of the area. And there's this term, geological term called Brady Seisman, which basically reflects this, you know, the tectonic movement of the area, but particularly the magma volumes in chambers beneath the Earth's surface, which are basically moving all the time. And over time, as I understand it, they cause the submergence of the site. So around sort of 1500s, the site became completely submerged. But I think it's still a problem today, along with a number of other things to do with erosion, etc.
Yeah, McKaylee was saying that. He was basically, he's incredibly enthusiastic and he loves it, but he was saying it's a very complicated place to look after. Anyway, I talked to him for hours. They had to drag me away, the crew. So let's hear a bit more from McKaylee about that. Spectacular underwater park.
The Park of Bio was established in 2001. So now we are at 21 years of activity. And now we are starting to see the real results. Because at the beginning it was, you know, look, people control the park, control the access. But now people are starting to be on the same line of the administrators. And this is working. We see that this is working. We see that when archaeologists start to work underwater, people is interested.
Yeah, absolutely. And apart from, you know, it's a great thing if we've got local people, visitors interested and coming and kind of helping, being mass preservers of this place. But what about other threats? Are there environmental threats or ecological threats or geological threats? Because this is a volcanic region, we know.
A marine park in a volcanic area is exposed to the movements of the volcanoes. The Park of Baia, in the entire coastal stretch of the Roman time, is now submerged because of a volcanic movement, the bradycism. The same movement is active now. We see that in the last 10 years, the level, the sea level in this territory changed, I think, of about 1 meter. Something huge for every city. The territory is changing continuously, and we have to imagine solution also for this. At the same time, the marine life is attacking everything. Of course, during 2000 years, the marine life protected this, but was also a menace for everything.
You're so passionate about your work. We're standing here in this place, which is frankly idyllic. I mean, you know, it's beautiful. Is there a particular find that you're excited about, or that you're excited about the possibility of discovering the future? Is there one thing here that is especially magical for you, or is it the whole 250 football pitches worth?
It's more than one, more than one thing. But for example, this year I've started another project very close in the coast of Puteoli, in the middle of the Roman commercial harbor of the late Republican time, and it is another incredible place because we know, for example, that in this place, under a little bit of sand, we have an entire Nabataean temple. So the basis of Syrian people, of Nabataean people, in the commercial center of Puteoli. It is underwater, it is under the sand, it is very close to the coast. We just need to excavate over there. We just need to dig and find it.
That's so exciting. So I'm obsessed with the Nabataeans, I have to say. So, that, you know, these are the people that trade incense and spices from Arabia. You know, that famously they build Petra, and they're incredibly involved too. And it's just another example of how the Mediterranean links these different cultures and civilizations. People aren't working in separate pods. It's all interconnected.
Absolutely. In, you know, this is also because when you are working in a commercial harbor, this is the typical result of a long life of an harbor. After the beginning, after the establishment of an harbor, the harbor converts itself in the center, in a little center of the world, because every single commercial enclave, every single commercial group will start to create a basis with sacred places like temples, commercial places, for example, for the change of money. And this is typical of medieval cities or modern cities. And all the structure related with the presence of people coming from abroad. In Pozzuoli, not underwater, but in the modern Pozzuoli, for example, under a modern house, there is an ancient taberna, there is an ancient Roman building. Now it's just the cellar of the house, just under the floor. But in this taberna that is dated back to the 2nd century AD, you have on the walls all the graffitos of people, of merchants, of sailors coming from everywhere in the Mediterranean. You have naval graffitos, we have ship graffitos, but you have the graffitos of people telling, I am from Smyrna, modern Turkey, and this is the best place of the world. And on the other, on another line, there is another one writing, no, the best place in the world is Rome. So it's the life of people making commerce, making trade in a port, in a harbor. And this is something incredibly related with our modern knowledge of a harbor life.
The brilliance of all archaeology, but particularly marine and maritime archaeology, as you said, it's a way that you can tie up what you're hearing in the sources. So there's little fragments of information that you get from the history, but it's real people and their lives that are coming to the surface for you. Yeah. So, I mean, this is a remarkable project, and I can tell just how busy you are, so I don't want to keep you from your work, but honestly, just thank you. It's exquisite being here, incredibly exciting, and I can, having read about these people, I can now imagine them walking these beaches, having their parties, writing their graffiti, bringing their goods in from across the Mediterranean.
So you even got Nabataeans as well as diving in. I don't know, all the things that you enjoy and love. I'm really jealous. I'm not going to show it, but...
I know. I mean, in that temple, that's quite a thing. And it's just, it does, it's sort of what I was saying at the end to Michele, that is the brilliance of archaeology, but particularly maritime archaeology. It genuinely rewrites history. So we're used to thinking about the Greeks and the Romans, and we kind of ignore this whole civilization that came from, you know, what was loosely termed Arabia. But he's just about to dig up a temple there. You know, just remarkable. And it must, Lucy, I suppose it must be exciting for you as well, because you have to have so many different people from so many different disciplines involved in a project like this, that it could really just incarnate a whole new way of working.
I think it's the way of working, to be honest with you, because you can't, nothing exists in a vacuum, and to understand sites in the landscapes, the changes that have occurred through time, you really need an injection of the geologists and the engineers as much as the historians and the archaeologists. And I think that's what's really exciting about the work they're doing here, that's very inclusive, it's very holistic, but it's also, going back to something we were picking up on earlier, was, you know, inclusive of the local communities. And the more you promote these sites, engage people, but it also brings in that well-needed cash. It drives the economy. And I think these are really important aspects of these underwater parks, because it brings in people and then it brings in the buck.
And in the case of Baia, it short circuits us into the pleasure principle of the Roman past, which is not a bad place to be short circuited into.
Absolutely. Well, that was really excellent. And thank you so much for listening to the Dive and Dig podcast, brought to you by the Honor Frost Foundation, a charity that supports research in maritime archaeology across the Eastern Mediterranean. Thanks for listening.
Bye.